Tuesday.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. As the anniversary of its invasion of Ukraine nears, Russian forces pounded the city of Bakhmut on Monday in what NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said was the beginning of a major, long-feared new offensive, Reuters correspondent Tamara Lindstrom reports.
The reality is that we have seen the start already, because we see what Russia does now, President Putin do now, is to send in thousands of more troops, accepting a very high rate of casualty.
Military officials said Ukrainian defenders, who have held on for months, were braced for new ground attacks. Bakhmut is a prime objective for Russian President Vladimir Putin, and its capture would give Russia a new foothold in the Donetsk region and a rare victory after several months of setbacks.
Reuters correspondent Tamara Lindstrom. As rescue operations have largely ceased in Syria, residents of areas in the northwest struck by the devastating earthquake are grappling with their new and worsening reality, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Many residents digging through the debris of their destroyed homes, picking up the remnants of their shattered lives and looking for ways to heal after the latest in a series of humanitarian disasters to hit the war-battered region. The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs has visited the Turkish-Syrian border and acknowledged in a statement that Syrians have been left looking for international help that hasn't arrived. Aid convoys face many hurdles accessing the rebel enclave of northwest and Syria that largely depends on outside aid for survival. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A man driving a rental truck swerved on sidewalks and plowed into scooter riders in New York City on Monday, killing one person, injuring seven others before police caught him. This is VOA News. An Israeli policeman was killed Monday and a Jewish teenager wounded in separate stabbing attacks carried out by Palestinian boys in annexed East Jerusalem, police said, amid a spike in violence. Earlier on Monday, Israel struck a Hamas base in Gaza after rocket fire from the enclave, and a Palestinian was killed as the army detained alleged attackers in the occupied West Bank. At least 20 civilians were killed in weekend militia attacks in a volatile province of Northeast Democratic Republic of Congo, the United Nations and local sources said Monday. Since the end of last year, the number of attacks by militants there, some allied with jihadist insurgencies, have left several dozen dead nearly every week. The White House said on Monday there's no indication of aliens or extraterrestrial activity after a series of shootdowns of unidentified objects over North American airspace.
I know there have been questions and concerns about this, but there is no indication of aliens or extraterrestrial activity with these recent takedowns.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, after on Sunday, a U.S. Air Force general said he would not rule out aliens or any other explanation yet, deferring to U.S. intelligence experts. After promising results in Eastern Europe, Google is launching a new initiative to teach people how to spot misinformation before they encounter it. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
They call it pre-bunking, educating people about the techniques common to misleading claims that spread like wildfire on the internet, like scapegoating, false comparisons, and missing context. Now, tech giant Google is launching a new campaign in Germany with short videos that will appear as advertisements on platforms like TikTok, YouTube, and Facebook. Beth Goldberg, who studies social challenges for a division of Google, says there's a real appetite for solutions. Content moderation prompts cries of censorship, and traditional journalism fact checks don't reach people who are already distrustful of the media. Pre-bunking videos are easy to produce and can be seen by millions. I'm Jennifer King.
The New Zealand government declared a national state of emergency Tuesday after a tropical storm lashed the North Island. The country's Minister for Emergency Management signed the declaration as tens of thousands of homes were left without power following heavy rain and strong winds. Floodwaters and landslides have cut off many settlements across the country, including some near Auckland, New Zealand's largest city. Find more on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, February 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, NATO chief says the much-anticipated Russian offensive against Ukraine has started.
The most important message is that we see no sign whatsoever that President Putin is preparing for peace or ready to negotiate something which will respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine.
Rescues continue in Turkey more than a week after the area was devastated by earthquakes.
Dragging live people out from the rubble and finding those who died in the rubble, that's coming to a close.
And the importance of radio broadcasting as the media marks World Radio Day. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters on Monday that a feared new major Russian offensive in Ukraine almost 1 year after Moscow launched the war has already started. Speaking ahead of a meeting of the military alliance, Stoltenberg said there were, quote, no sign, unquote, Russian President Vladimir Putin was preparing for peace. He called on NATO members to continue providing, quote, urgent, unquote, military support to Kyiv.
President Putin do now is to send in thousands of more troops, accepting a very high rate of casualty. The most important message is that we see no sign whatsoever that President Putin is preparing for peace or ready to negotiate something which will respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. What we see is that President Putin and Russia still wants to control Ukraine. And therefore, the only way to ensure that Ukraine prevails as a sovereign nation is to continue to provide military support to Ukraine.
That's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Ukraine's Prosecutor General Andriy Kostin has called for the creation of an ad hoc international tribunal to investigate and prosecute Russia for the crimes of aggression in Ukraine. Oleksiy Kovalenko has the story.
Both international and Ukrainian courts are investigating war crimes committed by Russia after it invaded Ukraine in February of last year. Now Ukrainian authorities are calling on the international community to create a tribunal to investigate and prosecute Russia for the crime of aggression. The Prosecutor General of Ukraine, Andriy Kostin, says it's a necessary step.
Ukraine calls for the establishment of the ad hoc special tribunal for the crime of aggression as most feasible and efficient route for accountability.
Kostin says it's up to the international community to hold Russia accountable because Ukraine's justice system cannot take legal action against leaders of a different country. And involving the UN is problematic because Russia is a permanent member of the UN Security Council and could veto any attempts to bring forward a case. The US State Department is considering various formats to potentially create an international tribunal. Clint Williamson, the former U.S. ambassador for war crimes, is on the international team to help Ukraine with the war crimes prosecution. He stresses the importance of having an office at The Hague.
I think as these discussions have progressed, as people have looked at other options, one of them that has been talked about is the creation of an interim prosecutor's office that would pave the way for ultimately establishing a tribunal, that we're making progress on this.
Also this year, President Biden signed the Justice for Victims of War Crimes Act, which makes it possible to prosecute alleged Russian war criminals in the United States. For now, the wheels of justice are moving slowly, especially on the international stage, and officials say it could be years before any alleged war criminal come to trial. Oleksiy Kovalenko for VOA News, Washington.
Rescues continued in Turkey's southeast on Monday, more than a week after the area was hit by earthquakes that have killed more than 37 people, and in neighboring Syria too. Turkey's worst earthquake in almost a century has left a trail of destruction that could cost Ankara up to $84.1 billion, a business group said, while a government official put the figure at more than $50 billion. United Nations aid chief Martin Griffith says the attention is now turning to providing aid to survivors.
Dragging live people out from the rubble and finding those who died in the rubble, that's coming to a close. And now the humanitarian phase, the urgency of providing shelter, psychosocial care, food, schooling, and a sense of the future for these people. That's our obligation now.
That's United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths. Today is the 12th anniversary of World Radio Day. UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, says radio is a powerful medium that celebrates humanity in all its diversity and constitutes a platform for democratic discourse. Mita Lorenko is UNESCO's Chief of Media Development. She tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that radio has been able to ride the technological advances of the times, including FM and AM, podcasts and streaming devices.
It still reaches the largest number of audiences around the world because of being a low-cost medium. But also it's a medium that gives you microphone, gives you the possibility of having your voice heard irrespective of the level of education of the person, of the instruction level, because other media required a bit more of education or ability than what radio does. And it's also the one for the breaking news, you know, because you only need a microphone to be there where the event is happening, when in fact other media need to mobilize camera teams or even mobilize graphic teams. If it's on internet, radio station just mobilizes, gets somebody there with the microphone, and an event which is very grave, as a shooting, for example, or a flooding, or other things like a storm. It could be a weather warning, you know, but it's always there immediately. And you see that people, when they see something on digital media, on internet, the first reaction is to turn on the radio station to see the radio, to see if it's really happening.
So, and that's not an old-fashioned thing. People still do that, don't they?
Yes, it's the parameter to see if it's true or not. So there are many other sides to radio that we can mention. I would tell your listeners to always keep a transistor at home. If it has DAB Plus, great, but always keep one, because in case of, well, let's say floodings that I mentioned, you don't have electricity, and at one point your mobile device will not have any more battery and you cannot plug it anywhere.
So as UNESCO points out, reporting and informing the general public, radio is still up there. It still shapes public opinion and it frames the narrative that can influence domestic, international situations. But radio can also be used as kind of a tool for the bad guys, right? I mean, if
yes,
they control the medium.
Yes, we have some horrible examples like Milko Lins, Rwanda, many years ago, so which spearheaded genocide. So when we are talking of the radio that serves as conflict prevention and peace building, we are talking of a radio that is editorially independent, that is free from political influence, commercial or ideological influence. And it's important that listeners learn to identify which are these radio stations, which are independent, which perform a quality journalism.
That's Mita Lorenko, Chief of Media Development for UNESCO, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Paris. Since his ouster from power in a parliamentary vote of no confidence last April, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has had a public falling out with the military, despite previously enjoying a close relationship with the country's most powerful institution. He accuses the then Army Chief General Kamal Javad Bajwa of conspiring with his political opponents to remove him from office with the help from the U.S. Allegations that Washington, the Pakistani military and the government has repeatedly denied. In a wide-ranging interview with VOA's Islamabad correspondent Sarah Zaman, Khan expressed hope the military will stop interfering in politics and keep friendly ties with the Taliban.
Well, first, let me just define what you mean by the military. Military means one man, the army chief. So the whole policy of military vis-a-vis their dealing with civilian government depends on the personality of one man. So in this case, the positive side during our relationship with General Bajwa rather than the military, when we were on the same page, which meant that we had organized strength of Pakistan army to help us, and we worked together, and Pakistan was considered one of the success stories of the COVID-19. Now, the problem was that General Bajwa favored some of the biggest crooks in this country, and he did not think corruption was this big a problem, and he wanted us to work with them. Work with them meant giving them immunity from the corruption cases. He had a very close relationship with Shehbaz Sharif, the current prime minister, and for some reason, he conspired. And this regime change took place.
Well, he rejects those allegations. But my question is, If you come back in power, what makes you think things will be different, that the army that has consistently played a huge role in Pakistan would back off?
Leading principle of the balance is that elected government that has the responsibility, which people have mandated them through their vote, must also have the authority. You cannot separate responsibility and authority. So if the authority lies with the army chief, responsibility lies with the prime minister, no management system works.
But do you believe it could be different next time? And if you don't believe it's going to be different next time, why do you want to run for election?
It can be because Pakistan is evolving all the time. And I'm sure amongst the new military leadership, there's a realization that this experiment of regime change has gone wrong. The economy has gone into a tailspin. We are facing the worst crisis in our history, the economic crisis. But not just that, the governance crisis. And there's no way to get out of this. The only way is that we have a completely paradigm shift from where the way Pakistan has been run.
You've been agitating for elections for almost 10 months now. But you've also said that you don't believe the next elections are going to be free and fair. Will you accept the results of the elections if your party does not win a majority?
They have completely destroyed their credibility as an impartial election commission. There won't be free and fair elections, but there will be elections.
But will you accept the results in case your party does not win a majority whenever the general elections happen?
That's premature to say, you know. I mean, how can I say right now the extent of rigging they'll do? There was a local government election in Sindh. All the political parties rejected the local government election. All of them. There will be rigging, but to the extent, I can't say right now.
Let's talk foreign policy. Do you believe that the Afghan Taliban government is friendly to Pakistan?
Well, firstly, whatever government is in Afghanistan, Pakistan must have good relationship with them. I tried my best with the Ghani government because our interest is that having good relationship with the government in Kabul means that we have a 2,500-kilometer border with them. And which means that, you know, if there are problems of terrorism, then they will help us.
But so far, even the Pakistani government says it's not getting the help from the Afghan Taliban to fight terrorism the way it would have liked and the way you were saying.
What is disturbing is that a foreign minister, he's spent almost all his time out of Pakistan, but he's not paid one visit to Afghanistan. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but do we want a repeat of what happened to Pakistan from 2005 onwards to 2015? Where Pakistan was going under, suffering from terrorism all along the Afghan border. So I think we are not in a position to have another war on terror. And the only way is to somehow get Kabul to work with us so that we can jointly deal with this.
That's former Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan speaking with VOA Islamabad correspondent Sira Zaman. Human rights groups say atrocities are continuing in Myanmar, 2 years after the military coup, despite ASEAN attempts to mediate. For the new ASEAN chair, Indonesia, the conflict is threatening to dominate the agenda. VOA's Yunis Salim explains in this report, narrated by Novar Pawadi.
In 2023, Indonesia took over the rotating chairmanship of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, from Cambodia. But one issue, the military rule of Myanmar, which began when the army seized power 2 years ago, threatens to overshadow other items on ASEAN's agenda. The U.S. State Department says there are credible reports that the military's crackdown on its opponents has resulted in thousands being jailed, tortured, or killed. Indonesian President Joko Widodo said that although Indonesia was committed to resolving the crisis in Myanmar, ASEAN would not be, in his words, held hostage to the Myanmar conflict. Andreika Natalegawa is an expert on Southeast Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
You know, we're only a very short period of time into Indonesia's chairmanship, but we're beginning to see the outlines of how it'll approach the Myanmar crisis. And we've seen a number of public statements by senior officials.
Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment, told the World Economic Forum in Davos in mid-January that it was time Myanmar's military leaders stepped aside to allow qualified people to lead. Meanwhile, President Widodo said Indonesia would send one of its high-ranking generals to Myanmar to offer advice on transitioning from military to civilian rule. Patrick M. Cronin is the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute.
I think Indonesia is serious about wanting to improve the situation in Myanmar, but I think they're also reluctant to look like they're meddlesome or to be counterproductive, to engage in counterproductive activity. And they don't think blanket sanctions, they don't think stopping all dialogue is very productive.
Since its founding in 1967, ASEAN has adopted a policy of non-intervention in internal affairs. And Myanmar's military regime hasn't made much headway towards implementing the five-point consensus it agreed to with ASEAN leaders in April 2021, calling for a cessation of hostilities and continued dialogue among the disputing sides. And that may force ASEAN's hand. President Widodo told the Reuters news agency he was prepared to act decisively if Myanmar did not comply with the consensus. But he did not elaborate on what actions Indonesia would take. For Yuni Salim, Nova Purwadi, VOA News.
In other news, Pope Francis has expressed sadness and worry at the news that Roman Catholic Bishop Rolando Alvarez, an outspoken critic of the Nicaraguan government, had been sentenced to 26 years in prison in the latest move against the Catholic Church and government opponents. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Dozens of international observers are in Nigeria to monitor February 25th presidential election as political parties round off their campaigns. Analysts are skeptical their presence will reduce growing concerns about scarcity of voter cards, election-related violence, and access to voting centers. For more on their activities since arrival, I spoke with reporter Munachi Chooks.
ECOWAS and European Union Election Observation Mission and all the international groups are right here in Nigeria, and they are committed to ensure we have credible elections. They have paid visits to the INEC chairman and resident electoral commissioner. They visited the six geopolitical zones of Nigeria, not forgetting the security agencies, traditional and religious leaders. Also, civil society groups, you know, having audience with all of them, all to know the preparedness of these stakeholders. And they also visited the 18 political parties because they play an important role in the election. Not forgetting the media, they're not left out, the Bar Association and the courts because of the role they'll play in the election.
There are reports of concerns by some of these observers about how this election is going, especially the build-up to the election when it comes to violence and other matters concerning this election.
They are skeptical of what could happen as we gradually get to the 2023 elections right here in Nigeria. But you know, importance Nigeria holds in West Africa. If Nigeria sneezes, the whole of West Africa catches a cold. The observers, too, they're hoping we have a smooth run. The major concern is insecurity. You know how it's been so far in the past few years in Nigeria. Insecurity has been the talk, kidnappings, terrorism and all of that. So these observers are concerned about that. And then again, the beavers that the INEC is bringing in is a new technology to the voting process in Nigeria. So INEC, they've assured that with the beavers, that the bimodal voting process is going to be a smooth run. So these observers say they're hoping that INEC will keep to their words so we have a credible election in Nigeria.
That's reporter Munachi Chooks speaking with me from Nigeria's capital city of Abuja. Australia has nominated a culturally sensitive Aboriginal area that is home to the world's largest collection of rock art for United Nations Heritage Protection. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The Burrup Peninsula, 1,500 kilometres north of Perth, the Western Australian state capital, has 50,000 years of First Nations history, including millions of a type of rock carving called petroglyphs. It's the world's densest known concentration of hunter-gatherer petroglyphs. The site has been nominated as a United Nations World Heritage Site. If accepted by UNESCO, it would become the second site in Australia listed for World Heritage for its Aboriginal cultural heritage. Environment and Water Minister Tanya Plibersek told reporters Friday The site is a natural wonder of the world.
This place has to be protected forever, and it has to be managed for the benefit of people who have connection to it, but managed for the benefit of all of humanity.
Rhys Whitby, Western Australia's Environment Minister, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation on Friday that the region has global significance.
It is putting it on par with such things as Stonehenge and the Great Wall of China, and I think it deserves that status. So this is very important, and it's a very emotional and important day for local traditional owners here.
The peninsula is also home to a huge fertiliser plant. Indigenous campaigners have blamed industrial emissions for damaging the region's ancient art. A federal investigator is assessing the claims that First Nations heritage is under threat. However, resources company Woodside, which operates in the region, has disputed any risk to its ancient heritage. It said in a statement that it had demonstrated its ability to work alongside Aboriginal people and the heritage values of the peninsula. The site's inclusion on the UN World Heritage List is expected to be considered by the World Heritage Committee next year. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Chinua Ofor in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Overall governance in Africa has failed to improve since 2019. Much of the continent was less safe, secure, and democratic in 2021 than in 2012, according to the Ibrahim Index of African Governance, which issues an assessment of the quality of governance in African countries every 2 years. In the past decade, leaders of an increasing number of African countries have found and implemented ways to avoid adhering to term limits. Since 2015, over a dozen presidents have managed to weaken, circumvent, or eliminate limits which had been set as a means of curtailing the amount of power vested in the executive branch of the government. This goes against public opinion. Afrobarometer's latest findings tell us that at 67%, solid majorities express a preference for democracy over any other kind of government, and clear majorities also endorse core democratic norms and institutions such as parliamentary oversight of the president, 65%, and term limits, 73%. When power is concentrated at the top, civil society's role is diminished and leadership is less likely to respond to the will of the people. The governing powers become resistant to new ideas and cling to the status quo, preventing advancement and development. Leaders who are not subject to the will of the people soon imagine that laws do not apply to them. They work to erode the power of other branches of government. They stifle political competition and silence criticism, often through use of force. And they surround themselves with those who never fail to agree with them, thus eliminating any possibility of reversing or amending bad decisions. Almost inevitably, they become prey to corruption. History shows that in countries without enforceable term limits and therefore consistent and accountable political transition, democracy suffers. And because democracy is essential for sustained peace, security, and human development, such countries tend to stagnate both economically and culturally. It doesn't have to be that way. The Ibrahim Index also shows that despite the backsliding in many places, more than half of Africa's population, 53%, now lives in a country where overall governance has improved between 2012 and 2021. And while some try to negate or manipulate term limits, 21 countries have strengthened term limits or plan to institute them. The United States stands with these forward-looking countries. Across sub-Saharan Africa, the United States is committed to promoting democratic norms and elections that reflect the will of the people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.